Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age, Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back, and with us also this week is Spencer. Hey, there.
Hi.
This week, we'll be taking a look, once again, at listener feedback. As with all of our podcasts, it should be noted that there will be spoilers. We range all over the series, you know, first book to last book, prequels, and, you know, even some things that haven't been written that we kind of like to surmise about. So if you've not read through the entire series, you may want to cut out just in case we, you know, accidentally spoil something for you.
Yeah, not only that, we might even actually spoil other series that don't have anything to do with the Wheel of Time, too. So, you know, you've been warned.
We won't warn you what we're talking about, but you'll know when you get spoiled.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's like a crowd, you know, it's like...
All right, we're going to start the voicemails this episode with one from Tracy, who is talking about Tam and Morghese.
Hi, this is Tracy. Just finished listening to the podcast about Gathering Storm. First of many, I'm sure. The one thing I was really hoping you guys would mention was, I think it was Tam mentioned to Rand about Morghese being alive and okay, and, you know, where did that come from? That seems like a really odd wrap-up of that to me, and I'm hoping that that's going to be explained more in Towers of Midnight, but I would really like to know your thoughts on that in a future podcast. Great work on the podcast. Thanks a lot. Looking forward to listening to more. Thanks.
Yeah, this was a good point. We mentioned this in one of our early Gathering Storm wrap-ups, which is at the moment currently still in editing. It is my opinion, at least, that when Tam first joined Perrin's group, that he would have recognized Morghese. My idea that either on the way back to the Two Rivers from the battle at the Blood Snow, or in his varied travels before he ends up meeting Cary and you know, adopting Rand, that he was in Camelin for a period of time, and while there would have at least seen at one point in time Morghese during one of her public audiences. The only other thought that I ever had about that that could explain it if this is not the case was that there is an entire chunk there that we don't get to see in this book, which I am assuming, like you said, will be in Towers of Midnight, where Nynaeve and Cad Swain arrive to gather Tam and actually bring him back to meet Rand. And during that time, the revelation of who Morghese actually is would have come out. Either way, I guess we'll find out probably in a future book, hopefully. If not, then in many of the appendices, which will probably likely follow.
I think it's more likely to be the second option there. Before the release of The Gathering Storm, when I was lucky enough to be a Storm Leader and listen to Brandon at the dinner beforehand, I think it was actually one of my questions he was answering, because I guess I hadn't kept up on TGS lore enough, and so I asked this question, and everyone else at the table was like, oh yeah, he's answered that, and Brandon was kind enough to go through it for me, but he said that in The Gathering Storm and Towers of Midnight, there are four groups. There's the Rand group, the Mac group, the Perrin group, and the other group. Gathering Storm took the Rand group and the other group three-fourths of the way to the last battle. Matt and Perrin only about one-fourth. Or was it one-third? Might have been one-third, I'm not sure. But in Towers of Midnight, he's going to bring everyone the last of the way to the last battle, however long that is for their different groups. And so I think that the scene where we see Morghese's identity revealed is going to be something that we are going to see in Towers of Midnight, but I have the feeling that it's going to happen when Perrin meets up with the White Cloaks, rather than when Perrin meets up with Nynaeve.
That's actually interesting. It also gives us, you know, an interesting side perspective, now that you've mentioned that, you know, where everybody is in relation. Because we do know that, yeah, a couple of the groups of characters really didn't get much, as, you know, you could almost call it page time, in this particular book. So that'll definitely be interesting.
I feel like a total idiot because I'm totally drawing a blank. Refresh my memory. Did Rand have, like, basically no reaction to the information that Morghese was alive?
He actually kind of, his first response was really disconnected. It was like, oh, does Elaine know?
This is when Rand is in crazy mode. He's not really paying attention. He's not really there. And it's only a couple of moments after this where Tam brings up Cad Swain and Rand goes completely ballistic and tries to kill Tam and then Gateway's out of there.
Yeah, that's what I thought. As I recalled, he basically had almost, you know, no serious, he just sort of blew right past that revelation like it wasn't of any consequence at all. And when you consider how much he's been beating himself up about all of these things that he takes responsibility for even when he shouldn't, that kind of surprised me.
Well, yeah, but he had been beating himself up about these in the last few books, but in the middle of Gathering Storm, when he had the chains and collar on him, and Semirog was torturing him. After that, he went to a darker place than we had ever seen him before, and he doesn't have remorse anymore. He doesn't have guilt at all, which is how he was able to balefire Grendel's entire palace out of existence.
Yeah, I actually attributed that both to the combination of where his mindset was prior to the Bracelets of Domination being placed on him, in combination with the influence and bleed through from Moradin, because in a lot of those really dark scenes for Rand, and even some of the comments he makes when he's not being particularly even dangerous, it seems a lot more like something Moradin or Shamael or whichever personality you want would say than Rand would. So, I kind of look at it that it might be a sort of weird combination. I really do think that Moradin's bleeding through into Rand very heavily at that point in time. And, you know, the lower he got on the spectrum, the more that bleed through was affecting him and his decisions.
Yeah, I have to agree on that one. I think there is a lot of, well, now that not only do we have the physical crossover between them, but the mental crossover, as you say, is bleeding through as well. They're becoming more and more connected rather than less.
Well, especially too, because Rand started wearing a lot of red and black right after he started going to the darker place. And it was just like, wow, that seems really influenced, you know, he's now wearing Moradin's colors subconsciously. That's just a little messed up.
Yeah, I'm going to throw in a little disagreement on that, because starting out in the very beginning when Moraine has those coats made for him in Shinar, he's got a red one and a black one. He's had those colors hung on him from the beginning almost. Remember, it was the red and the black one that he had that caused, you know, the Matt and Perrin to, you know, deride him about taking on airs, about being a lord. You know, he pulls the stuff out of his pack and he goes, ah! You know, and they come running over thinking he's been attacked or something. Ingtar, you know, teases him about, well, at least if we have a feast, you'll be dressed for it and all that sort of stuff. And I remember those really vividly. And in fact, they're even depicted on one of the covers for sure. I know he's got the red coat with the brambles up the sides on one of the covers. Might have been Fires of Heaven.
It's very possible. I do remember that now. And you're right. Rand has worn a lot of red previously. It seems like, though, the clothes that he's wearing this time around are like red with black trim or black with red trim. They're very specifically the exact combination, whereas previously we've seen him in, you know, a red coat with gold scroll work or a black coat with silver scroll work type thing, and it seemed more ominous that the colors were more directly paired this time. I mean, like I said, he has had those colors with him for a long time too, and maybe I'm making more out of it than needs to be made, but, you know, for some reason, just one of those things that really popped in my mind that they really started being more prominent in the description, I think, once he started going to that place. And yes, it was Fires of Heaven. He's got a long red coat with some kind of gold leafy filigree sort of pattern on the chest and the sleeves.
Well, he's got similar cloaks in a lot of them. I mean, the Great Hunt, he's got something similar to that. The Fires of Heaven, he has a much longer one. Book 7, Crown of Swords, he has a sleeveless version of the coat. And then, you know, Gathering Storm, he has one, but it's, again, rather than the red and gold that had been prominent through the rest of the series, it's the red and black.
Yeah, but, you know, and he chose black for the Ashaman as well, so obviously it's a color that's close to his heart, so to speak.
That's true. I mean, obviously, the color depicted and associated with Sidon is black. You know, the Aes Sedai have a lot of white associated with them because of the flame of Tar Valon and Sidar. So it kind of makes sense that black would be a predominating color with the Ashaman being associated with Sidon.
Now it's going to be funny. When we find out that in the Age of Legends, the ancient Aes Sedai symbol, the white actually stood for the Sedain and the black for Sedar.
That would be funny.
That would be. And I'm only going to bring this up because we were talking about Rand's state of mind a little earlier, and I have a despairing feeling that the episode that was mentioned in might be one of the ones that was lost with my various computer failures and so forth. But I'm so excited that I totally nailed it that one time. I remember I was really sick and I could barely talk, but let alone sing. But then I said, Rand's just going to wake up and he's going to have a Dr. Horrible moment, you know, and he's going to, I hesitated, now I wonder why, sort of thing. And that's exactly what he did with Grendel, which we totally attribute to the Moradin leak through, I think. But I just thought that was really pretty funny. It was one crossover that really worked, and I predicted it. Uh-huh. I'm so petty.
It was totally still a good call on your part, so.
If only I could sing properly to pull it off, but I'm not even going to attempt it right now.
Well, coming up next in our listener voicemail is Eddie. And Eddie has a point of correction for us on our episode 63.
Yes, how you doing? My name's Eddie. I'm a big fan of the podcast. I'm just calling about a mistake, actually, that was made in podcast 63. I believe he was speaking about Shadow Haran being the first Shadow Spawn to have a point of view, and that was him, actually. In Chapter 6 of the A Crown of Swords, you have a point of view from him when you see Samael and Grendel speaking to the Shaido. So that was the first time that we have a Shadow Spawn point of view, and it wasn't by the Golem, actually. That's all. Thank you.
I really remember when we recorded this one. This was one of the episodes where Andrew and I were together because, unfortunately, Virginia was sick at the time. But I remember that this was actually one of my statements that I said. We were talking about the Golem's point of view and how I said that this is probably the first point of view we've had from a Shadow Spawn. And now I've been corrected, which is absolutely great. These are great forms of feedback to get because it tells us that, number one, you're listening enough, and number two, you're smarter than we are. And that's always nice to know that your listeners are smart enough that they'll call you on things, but that you can also make them think about stuff.
I remember recording the episode. I didn't remember the slip so much. I knew that it was either Shadow Haran or the Golem, which was our first Shadow Spawn point of view. And obviously we are amazingly human and every now and then we miss something. So it is good when someone else catches it because I know I like to be as right as much as possible, and it's always good to have the correct information. So thank you for that, Eddie.
And it wouldn't even be on just, the Golem is our first Shadow Spawn, because I was incredibly adamant about, yeah, it's our first Shadow Spawn. No, it wasn't Shadow Haran. No, what are you thinking about? No, that was Moradin. No.
I seem to think, to remember agreeing that, you know, I had also thought that that point of view from the woods was also Moradin, and it seems to me that there were, in those sort of middle books, there were two scenes where someone was watching somebody from the darkness, or from the, like, a wooded scene, and one of them was Moradin, and one of them was Shadow Haran, and I think our discussion on that particular episode did kind of confuse me a little bit as to which scene was which. So, you know, like I said, it definitely can occur. I would love it if I had an encyclopedic memory of all things that happened in the Wheel of Time. And sadly, I do not.
Well, here, I'm just going through Encyclopedia Watt, which is one of our favorite resources. It is absolutely phenomenal. But, and I found out why it was so confusing. In A Crown of Swords, when Samael is dealing with the Shado, there are two times when he is being watched, and both times it's from different people. So I think that's probably part of the confusion.
Well, I just gotta say, you guys are too nice. If anybody contradicts me, they're toast. No, I'm just kidding. I make mistakes all the time. I just try to edit them out if I'm doing the episode. No, I'm trying to remember those things. I do remember the one where the watcher, you know, is swathed in fan cloth, you know, is spying on Samael and Grendel. I'm sure that was Moradin, right? Then there was the other one where it was, you're right, Shida Haran. And they're very close in time, as I recall. I don't have an encyclopedic memory either. I wish I did, but the older I get, the stupider I get. So there you go.
Yeah, I definitely would say that the fan cloth figure was probably Moradin, because obviously Shida Haran would have no real need of a fan cloth suit. And I'm not even certain he would wear one if he could. I mean, it seems like we don't see Myrdral in anything else up until Knife of Dreams, when, you know, Shada Haran decides, I'm going to have a wardrobe change.
No more sneaky armor for me. That's so passé. So what was he wearing instead? I know you've got me. I'm sitting here thinking, wait a minute, what was he wearing then?
He's essentially wearing just a black suit, if I remember properly. It seemed really weird. It was like the armor fell off and he was just kind of like, aha! Only, you know, sounding like a snake crawling across dead leaves and, you know, leather rasping against, you know, whatever other sorts of descriptions are usually applied to a Myrdral's voice.
Are you talking about the scene where he put the hurt on Mesaana?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, basically revealed himself to be the Dark One, basically using the Super Fade as an avatar, if you will. Oh, there's a crossover we haven't done before.
I'm not sure that we've actually done a recording since Avatar came out.
Oh, gosh, no, that came out around Christmas time, didn't it? Surely we've done something since then. Yeah, I know we have, but it just didn't come into our consciousness. Okay, well, moving right along. Who's next, Spencer, on the list of emails?
Next we have, and I'm absolutely sorry if I get this name wrong, but I'm not very good at trying to pronounce things correct. We've had several times just tonight where I've pronounced things absolutely completely off. So if I'm saying your name wrong, I'm incredibly sorry. But we actually have two from Satib, but we're going to play one, talk about it, and then we'll do the other. And the first one is talking about quite a few things. Satib is talking about Rand, Moradin, Luthien, and the Boar.
Hi, this is Satib Bapat. I'm actually calling from India. I'm actually listening to your podcast quite regularly. I'm a fan of Robert Jordan. I've been reading all the books for a long time. I just listened to your last podcast, which is a mini podcast, just after the last book came out. A couple of thoughts which I came to my mind were, I just wanted to point them out. One was that I do believe the link with Moradin is what allowed Rand to use the true power. And one more point I would like to mention is that in the discussions with Luthien, we heard that because the male Aes Sedai used the power to seal the prison, there was the male power connected with the Dark One, and that's what gave it the backlash on the male Aes Sedai power and drove them mad. And he knows that he cannot use the male power to seal the board again. So what he's going, I believe that the secret is that with his access to the one power, he will actually use the one power to seal the Dark One's own prison. And as the one power touches the Dark One, and there's not going to be any backlash. And that's how the board will be actually closed, by using the true power and not by using either the male power or the female power. This is a thought which occurred to me. I thought I would just leave a message. I'm sure somebody else must have come up with similar suggestions or different suggestions. Just wanted to put that across. But you have fans in India, and I know a couple of our friends listen to the podcast. Just wanted to say that keep up the good work. Thanks.
Wow, it's really great to have listeners from as far away as India and some of the other places that we we get voicemails and emails. That's beyond cool. Thanks for doing the voicemail. We appreciate that.
I do know that we have had this theory voiced, and I believe we kind of discussed it in one of our Gathering Storm podcasts, which at the time of this recording is still in editing. Side note, anybody who wants to help us with editing, shoot us an email. We will be more than happy to pile you down with hours and hours of, you know, sometimes mind-drubbing data that, you know, we eventually coalesce into a listenable podcast. We kind of came down on a half of us were in favor of the idea of using the true power to seal the Dark One back into his prison, and half of us against, but for several varying different reasons, if I remember properly. I think I ultimately came down on the against side, but it was one of those ideas that the Dark One and the true power are an inherently destructive force, and using it to reseal, repair, reconstruct the prison would go against what the nature of the Dark One was. It was a really metaphysical decision in my or discussion at the time, and I'm fairly certain we didn't come to any meaningful cohesion in our decisions. It was one of those we kind of agreed to disagree moments.
Well, yeah, and then a lot of what we do isn't deciding, yes, this is what the Fourth Age podcast has agreed on. It's saying, well, here's my point of view, here's your point of view, here's their point of view. And we let the listeners hear all our different sides and all our different arguments. It's been incredibly recently, because I'm pretty sure in our last podcast there was another voicemail that dealt with something similar. And so we talked about it at length there. And I think we did have an even number of people, because it was a pretty even split. And it's hard to get even splits with three people.
I do like, though, I do like the idea in this particular voicemail that in using the true power rather than any version, combined or uncombined version of the one power, to seal the bore, that any sort of backlash would just reverberate back to its source, that being the Dark One himself. And therefore, if it is possible to seal the bore using the true power instead of the one power, that there wouldn't be a backlash to the people using it because they aren't inherently connected to the thing they're using to seal the war with.
Well, I'm going to come down on the side that I sort of disagree that it would be inherently impossible for Rand to use the Dark One's true power, which is basically, was just described as sort of a destructive force, to do something constructive, because certainly you can use Side in and side R for good or ill, either one. And I don't think that, I think it's basically a tool. I don't think it's impossible to do something good with the true power. I think it's, I'm kind of coming down on the side where I think Rand will somehow, sort of like he just invented the way to cleanse Sidene with his, you know, tube and his flowing of Sidene around side R and channeling it through the one through the other and everything. That was incredibly creative and inventive. And I think he'll come up with some way to combine all of the powers that he has access to and weave them together in a way that has never been seen before. And perhaps some of the other, you know, powerful channelers surrounding him, you know, like Cad Swain or Loghain or, you know, one of the other, you know, one of the Wonder Girls or somebody, you know, they may join with him and come up with something that's never been done before. I think the rest of the series is going to be all about things that have never been done before. I don't think we're ever going to see a repetition again of what's gone before. I don't think after the last battle things are going to go back to the way they were in the Age of Legends. And so I don't think that the way that they used to get through the last battle are going to be repetitions of what they've done before. Whatever he does to seal the bore, I'm really rambling on here, I'm sorry, I kind of go back to what Herod Fell said, where you have to clear away the rubble in order to build again. I think he's going to end up somehow destroying the seals, destroying the Dark One's prison, and just re-sealing it all together in a new prison or just destroying the Dark One altogether, if that's even possible. But that's just my rambling sort of crazy theory right now.
Well, and it's definitely possible that you might be correct. It is the joy of having two more books left, is that we actually will have that much more to read and discover along the way. I'm very certain, knowing both Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson, that there will not be a lack of creativity as the story draws to a close.
No, I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Sateev's other voicemail is dealing with Rand and his blindness.
This is Sudhir Bapat again. One more thing which I wanted to leave a message for, I forgot to mention earlier, was the last sentence of the in the book, which talked about the Shandar prophecies of the dragon. The prophecy said that the blind man will stand on his own grave and there he will see again. I think that's pretty much what happened at the end of the book. Dragon Mount was Lucerne's grave. He was standing on the Dragon Mount and he saw the whole, all his previous lives, and he reintegrated his own personality into one, and he actually could see why he was fighting this particular battle. The only question here is, and does it mean that Rand is not going to go blind? Tuan also mentioned somewhere that he doesn't seem to be blind yet. It's probably the blind was a metaphor and not actually going blind in terms that he cannot see. He could not see why he was fighting the battle, and he can see that now. It remains to be seen, but it's possible that Rand actually will not go blind. He'll be able to see as he sees right now. Just a thought, but throwing something up for discussion. Thanks, bye.
You know, I really like that. We do have to kind of assume that the last verses, the prophecy that was put into the end of The Gathering Storm, was meant to talk about the last chapter of The Gathering Storm. But yeah, that does raise the question, is Rand actually going to go physically blind? I mean, at the end of Knife of Drains, when he had a fireball blow up in his face, we had Nynaeve say, "Oh, there's something wrong with your eyes. I can't tell what it is. I'm not sure if I can fix it." And we kind of assumed this was supposed to lead him down the path to blindness or something. But if that isn't what was meant by the term he was going to go blind, then I think this is one of the best red herrings that Robert Jordan had put in the books, in all of them. Well, except Lanfear.
Well, I don't know about the blindness being a red herring, but it certainly might have been metaphorical, and I rather like that, but that does sort of cast some shadow on some of the references to the Fisher King and so forth, in Moradin's case, the Fisher, who has always worked with the, you know, wounds in his side and a rag tied around his eyes and so forth and so on, and that was an actual physical blindness, and Rand did have some sight loss, which was... I was going to say it was foreshadowed in the very first book, but that was Matt that was sort of blinded by the blast of Sidene that broke them out of their little jail cell. But yeah, I don't know. I would rather see it be metaphorical, and that Rand has now moved past the spiritual blindness that he's been laboring under, in addition to his loss of sight, even though it's not total blindness, because that would certainly leave him a lot healthier and more whole at the end of it, and I am of the camp that he will survive and hope he does. That's kind of my take on it. I like the idea that it could be just a metaphor for blindness, because he's certainly been laboring under a lot of delusion, and if that's not a form of blindness, I don't know what is.
Well, and I could be incredibly wrong. It might just be me hoping that things will be better than they'll actually turn out to be, but it seems to me like after the, I call it Rand's conversion, after Rand's conversion on Dragonmount, things are going to start being incredibly better, and I hope that we're going to see the wounds and such in his sides disappear. Obviously, he can't get his hand back. With things like the sight and the wound in his sides, the wounds in his side, and these things that we've always tied to the Fisher King and the Fisher prophecies, when they start to disappear, does that mean that Rand is no longer playing the same game as Moradin? What's the metaphorical meaning there? I always have this vision of Rand coming in to grabbing Min around the waist and spinning her around, and, you know, reminiscent of George Bailey at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, going around town shouting, "I'm so happy with the world. I'm going to jail. Yay!
Free at last! Free at last! There's always room for a game-changing thing in here. I mean, it's been said repeatedly that the prophecies are just prophecies. They don't have to be fulfilled. They aren't carved in stone. And these people all do have free will, and they can change, they can grow, they can do all sorts of things. So one can only hope that Rand will be able to stop playing Warden's game, stop being the Fisher, and be able to play his own game, especially now that he's had his epiphany. So, I don't know. We're getting into some serious philosophical ground here.
Yeah, in relation to the blindness, I did say very early in my first impressions of the Gathering Storm episode that I really did think that Rand's blindness was definitely meant to be metaphoric. And then I went to look both in Encyclopedia Watt and just in general through the books to find the point where it says that he's going to be, you know, have a bandage tied about his eyes and he would be walking on walking with a beggar's staff. And for some reason, I am not even right now as I'm looking it up, you know, online, able to find the exact point where the exact point or who tells him or reflects that was part of the vision. I see in, yes, Eye of the World, one of the things that Min sees in her first viewing of Rand is a sword that isn't a sword, a golden crown of laurel leaves, a beggar's staff, you pouring water onto sand, a bloody hand and a white-hot iron, three women standing over a funeral bier with you on it, black rock wet with blood, lightning around you striking, or some striking at you, some coming out of you, and that he and she would meet again. I'm not exactly certain where we get the idea that Rand would physically go blind. It might just be that I'm looking in the exactly wrong place for it. I like the idea of the metaphoric blindness. I like the idea of the blindness being a metaphor as opposed to a real thing, because I honestly, personally, at this point, think that Rand's gone through enough physically. He doesn't need any more debilitating injuries.
You know, about the prophecies, the Wheel of Time is so great because not only are there the prophecies that Robert Jordan actually gives us in the texts, but then there's also all the ties he makes to our own mythology and mythical heroes and the stuff of our legends. And so I think a lot of the stuff like Rand going blind is derived from the knowledge of various Wheel of Time fans of our legends and our mythology and drawing the parallels between the two. And I could be completely off base. I don't know that much about our own mythology and legends and such. I don't even know Arthurian legend that well, which is sad considering it's the most prominent, especially in today's culture. But
well, I'm pretty sure it was Morden who first gave us the reflection on the Fisher, which, you know, I immediately tied to the legend of the Fisher King, which was, you know, pretty, it's not hugely widely known, but it's a fairly well-known tale. It's sort of a morality tale, if you will. He's playing, what do you call it, T'Charon, I can never pronounce that properly, sort of what I think of as their version of chess, and he's reflecting on the various pieces and their moves, and the one is the Fisher and how the Fisher changes based on the square that he is. When he's on one side square, he's strong in attack and weak in defense, and when he's on the other side square, he's the reverse, and how he's always worked as a man leaning on a staff with the bandage tied around his eyes, etc., etc., etc. And that's sort of the first place that we really see that, other than the, you know, various foreshadowings of the blindness earlier in the books. I don't know, it could go either way. I agree with you, Andrew. He's definitely been through enough. I would like to spare him being blind as well as everything else. I have to confess that I put a lot of emotional investment into the capture of Semirog and was really almost devastated when she was killed, because I just had it fixed firmly in my mind that she was going to be the key to healing some of Rand's emotional, physical, and spiritual maladies, because she was the greatest healer of her age. And if they could have only somehow compelled her or harnessed her or turned her to the good or something, I think that she could have healed Rand's hand and some of the other things. But that's not an option now, unless Well, unless Cad Swain got more out of her than we've heard.
And like I say, I think that a lot of the, especially the wounds in his sides, are going to start healing now because of what he did rather than what someone else did for him. It's an action he undertook and he did for himself. It's much better for him to do it himself than for someone else to come in and do it for him. Even if that someone else would be able to heal him and make him as good as new, well, he still has all the emotional baggage to deal with. And I think that emotional baggage that he got rid of himself is a lot of what was creating the physical maladies that he was laboring under.
I actually have found the point where we actually see the bandage covering eyes. I finally found the reference to it. It is in the Shadow Rising, the chapter entitled The Price of Departure, and it is actually one of Perrin's wolf dreams. He is going through various different things. Amidst them is Egwene standing amidst a crowd of women, her eyes in fear, and slowly all of them kneeling to him. And then that window closes, and the window opens on Matt, standing naked and bound, snarling. An odd spear with a black shaft had been thrust across his back behind his elbows, and a silver medallion, a fox head, hung on his chest. And then finally, Matt vanishes, and it is Rand. Perrin thought it was Rand. He wore rags and a rough cloak, and a bandage covered his eyes. That is where the bandage, in relation to who we believe is Rand, comes into play. We have determined I am not at least crazy for this.
Oh, you're crazy, but you're right about that.
Well, that's why I said for this.
You know, sometimes I just lie awake thinking that, what if, like, Brandon finds time to listen to this occasionally and is just sitting here laughing his socks off because we're so wrong?
Hey, we find time to listen to his podcast. He should listen to ours.
I'm ambivalent whether I hope he does or I hope he doesn't. I mean, this is the man who knows. We could be providing endless fodder for amusement. On his part, I don't know.
Well, I think Maria and Alan know more just because they've worked with it longer, because we know that Brandon still goes to them. And we know that they listen to it, so I can't imagine what kind of chuckling Maria's been doing as she's been listening to our podcasts.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of scary.
As long as they're not cursing our pronunciations, which we apologize for continuously.
We're just fans of the series like you guys. We can't claim any special knowledge. We have no special lock on the correct pronunciations. In fact, that's one of the things that we want to try and get Maria on the show for, is to quiz her about the various pronunciations, because she's the go-to gal for that.
So our next listener voicemail is anonymous, and Anonymous has feedback for us concerning Matt, Rand, Tuan, Towers of Midnight, and Asmodian.
Hey guys. One of the things that I think would be extremely interesting to see happen eventually is whenever Matt and Rand finally do get together after all this time, and Rand finds out that Matt is married to Tuan, or now Empress Fortuana, the amounts of political maneuvering that can be done there, if it's done right, would just be absolutely amazing to witness. The other interesting thing, I think, is the title of the next book, The Towers of Midnight. That's the name, if I remember correctly, of the actual Shan Shan prison towers back on their mainland across the ocean. It says that the first Aes Sedai who presented the Shan Shan with the Domine, her screams pierced the Towers of Midnight, or something similar to that. I always wanted to know if the books themselves would ever actually go to the Shan Shan homeland beyond the scene where the Empress and the entire court of the Blood were completely slaughtered. And of course, we still don't yet know who killed Asmodian, but that should be coming up at some point, we hope, unless they just tack it on to an appendix at the end of A Memory of Light, just saying, for those of you who still didn't get it, even though it's supposed to be intuitively obvious. So, alright, thanks for hearing me out. Keep up the good work.
I know who killed Asmodian. It was Robert Jordan, of course.
A lot of what the caller brings up concerning Matt and Rand and the political maneuvering that can take place once it is revealed that Matt is married to Her Imperial Majesty really depends on the reuniting of, well, not only Matt and Rand, but of Matt and his wife. Yes, I am not favored of her name and therefore not like to say it as often as I can possibly manage to avoid it. I do think, yes, Matt is the way to get Rand and the Empress back into the same boat together. And I think as long as Rand, with his epiphany at the end of the book, as long as he maintains a certain amount of humility, the entire process of both bowing before the Crystal Throne and binding the Empire to him should go relatively smoothly, but it's always going to have to be a conduit through Matt. Matt is definitely going to be the facilitator for that.
You know, in terms of political maneuvering, I don't see too much happening for a couple of reasons. The first is, I don't think that new Rand will be doing much political crap, because when you get into politics, it's all just crap. I mean, you know, there are things that aren't politics, that are governments working with each other and such, and those are good, but politics is crap. And I don't see Rand doing much of that after the conversion on Dragonmount. But also, I don't think that there's going to be enough time after Rand and Matt get back together for them to do much, if anything, with Matt's relationship with the two of them. Obviously, he is going to have to be a go-between and soothe whatever feelings need to be soothed between the two. But I don't think there's going to be much time to do it, because I think that the three of them, the three boys, aren't going to get back together until right before or right after the beginning of the last battle.
I almost wonder if we're not reading too much into Rand's epiphany or conversion, as we called it, on Dragonmount. I mean, yeah, he's had a healing experience, but he's still the same man with the same burdens and the same stresses. It's not like, you know, now everything is going to be all wonderful. He's going to be pooping rainbows and surrounding himself with warm, cuddly puppies. He's still got a really onerous burden to carry and a very difficult job to do, and all of the stresses that were surrounding him are basically still there. I could see him relapsing into the darkness again, and I can see him doing some really dark deeds just because, you know, he's really prone to convince himself that it's necessary to do things that he doesn't think he should do in his heart of hearts. I don't know, but I'm not quite sure how, even with Matt as the intermediary, that there's going to be a real reconciliation between Rand and Fortuana, may she live forever. They're both such polar opposites. I loved the scene, though, where she nearly fell under his Taveran sway. I mean, she wanted to agree with him, and she really was like right there, but then she exerted her will and dragged herself back and put her little foot down and said, no, I'm not going to do any of these things, so to speak. That was a really cool scene.
Yes, it definitely was. I honestly kind of see, I liked the fact that in a way she was a little shocked that she did it as well. Like, out of nowhere, suddenly, you know, she says no, and you can almost see the mental double take. Like, did I actually just do that? And I thought that was amazing.
Yeah. Well, if there's anyone who's reading too much into Rand's conversion, it's definitely me, because I guess I'm always one. I like to see the bright and happy Mary Poppins endings where the whole family goes out to fly a kite. What can I say? I was raised on Disney.
Me too. I'd like to see that too. I really would. Pollyanna, when it comes to that stuff too, I want everything to be all wrapped up with a nice pretty bow and everybody to live happily ever after, or at the very worst, to die heroically like Ingtar, saving the universe or whatever needs to be done. But I just have this really, I got a bad feeling about this kid. I don't think it's going to wrap up so sweetly and nicely. I'm not sure Robert Jordan was going to wrap it up so sweetly and nicely, and having seen the end of Mistborn, pretty sure Brandon's on board with that too. I don't think there's going to be a really, you know, let's all fly a kite and run to the field of flowers ending on this one, much to my dismay. But there you go. That's what I think.
So who's going to die?
Everyone.
Oh, the Darkwood wins. Okay.
No, the Dark One loses, but, you know, like, you know, 50%, I think Well, the only ones we know absolutely positively for sure, you know, is assuming that Brandon hasn't changed canon, which I don't think he would, but Robert Jordan said he was going to write a book about Matt and Tuon after the last battle. So, I mean, unless something's changed in that plot line that we don't know about, I would put all my money on that gamble that Matt and Tuon are going to survive. But I could easily see him taking out, you know, any number of characters for one thing. There are so many of them. And I mean, so many of them are really major characters. You know, there are lots and lots of minor characters in this book, but there's a whole tier of characters that are virtually major characters in their own right, but only overshadowed by the, you know, the big 10 or 12 or whatever that we think of as the major characters.
All right. I have it. It's the big reveal. This is how the series ends. The creator, having been up all night, decides that it's about 4 a.m. and really needs to get some sleep. So, you know, shuts down the computer and then only then realizes that he forgot to save.
No! There will be blood. It might be years ago. Kill someone's on bad horse.
The world ended in a blink.
Dark One wins, world ends, film at 11. Well, that was Robert Jordan's short story. Really short story.
Yep.
Now, that was like a contest or something. No, I think it's going to end, you know. Well, I said that we wouldn't have a repeat of what happened before, but I could kind of foresee a little, you know, Ghostbusters sort of thing. Don't cross the streams! No! Ah! Too late. That would be bad. A complete protonic reversal.
Well, see, and it wasn't something I had ever thought about before, but the way that Brandon ended the Mistborn trilogy was absolutely phenomenal to my mind, and I was not expecting it. It wasn't anything I had ever thought of before, but after I read it, it's like, that's one way that you could end the Wheel of Time perfectly. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen that way and be that perfect.
I didn't think that was perfect at all. I didn't find that a satisfying ending at all. I mean, it made perfect sense. It was wonderfully written, and it was a shock to me. Didn't see it coming, but I just walked away feeling like, well, huh, okay. You know, what can I say? That was not my favorite book.
That's just because you didn't like the fact that Ellen got his head cut off.
Bonus just, for the actor.
It just, what?
Hazard pay.
Oh, God.
No. Awesomely cool death scene.
Yeah, they get to cut your head off. Just hope that they have the money to do it in CG. Don't have to do it live action.
Spoiler warning.
Not liking it.
All right, let's go back to voicemail.
The only reason I would would hope that the ending of Mistborn is not reminiscent of the ending of The Wheel of Time is that, you know, that would have to be an amazing letdown to have followed a series for so long and, you know, written your own trilogy and then found out that the ending was already in the works for another series.
I don't know.
But yes, back to voicemail.
Next voicemail.
Our next one is also from an anonymous caller, and he's talking about Brigitte and her memories.
Hey, everybody. Just wanted to call in. Love the show. Had a couple thoughts on Brigitte and her memories fading. My hypothesis is the only reason that she remembers any of her former lives is because she was, you know, pulled out of the pattern. She wasn't spun out. So my thought process is any other time she was spun out of the pattern normally, she probably didn't remember anything she did in her former lives. So I would think that just the fact that she doesn't remember what she did in her past lives shouldn't stop her from being the hero that she really needs to be. And my one other interesting question I had was, what happens when the horn is blown now? You know, would she get drawn to her? Is she going to be there anyway? Just something to think about. Keep doing the show. Love it. Take care. Bye.
That's a cool idea. What happens when the horn is blown now? Is she going to drop dead and then appear with the heroes? That would be cool. I'm serious, you know? What happens when, you know, it's sort of like Egwene's thing about the Oathrod. You know, what happens when we bind the kin? Are they suddenly going to fall over dead because they're already older than they should be? You know, if sound the horn, is Brigitte going to just immediately keel over and be spun out again with the heroes of the horn and ride into battle? I don't know. That could really kind of wrap up her storyline real quick.
I think the two are bound together. I think the two questions that the caller brought up go together. The fact that Brigitte is losing her memories, I think, is part of the pattern trying to bring her kind of into par with the rest of the threads and everyone else who was spun out naturally rather than suddenly ripped out of Tel Iron Honoriad, trying to bring her kind of into the regular order of things as the pattern is, it would treat her, or the horn would affect her the same way it affected Rand on Tolman Head. And that is, if I'm remembering correctly, there was something about it that kind of pulled him and was familiar or something, that there was a feeling associated with it, but it didn't kill Rand and spin him out as the Dragon Reborn, even though we all know that he's been tied to the wheel and he's one of the heroes of the horn. Because he had been spun out, because he was now part of the living pattern, rather than part of the heroes who were hiding in the waiting rooms of Teller and Onriad, he didn't get called by the horn, even though he was there where the horn was born, where the horn was blown. And I think that the same thing would apply to Brigitte. And also we know Gaedael Kane, who has been spun out naturally, and any other heroes who are currently living rather than hiding in Teler and Onriad.
Yeah, I definitely think that those who are already spun out won't be suddenly reabsorbed and you know, reappear as their grand, glorious, heroic selves. Mainly because when we look at what happened on Tommen Head, it would be just too much of a, oh, the good guys have the magic amulet, and the magic amulet calls forth the indestructible army. You know, I think if we have a number of heroes who are out in the world and maybe they haven't reached their full potential, I mean, for all we know, Geidel's in swaddling clothes and diapers right now, with less of them being present, it kind of at least has a hair towards more balancing the equation a little bit. I liked the caller's comment, her loss of memories shouldn't matter, that, you know, it should just be a kind of wake-up call that Birgit can do what she needs to do. She doesn't need her memories. She's never needed them before from her previous lives, so why should she need them now? You know, she's still, you know, a totally awesome archer and, you know, a very charismatic leader of people without being, you know, a king or a queen or something, and that she can still be a general, she can still be a hero, and her memory shouldn't actually matter. So yeah, I think by the end of the last battle, maybe she doesn't remember anything more than her name is Birgit, and, you know, she's attached to Elaine Sedai. You know, who knows?
Well, and I kind of want to take it on a digression or a tangent here that's still important, is what actually is the effect of the Horn of Valir? Because it seems to me, and it could just be that my mind works in funky ways, but it seems to me like it's kind of pulling this area of the world into Teler and Onriad so that the heroes who are always in Tar can go and affect it. And if that's true, then we have, at the last battle, we have the real world intersecting with the dream world, which, with what we know of Teler and Onriad, that's going to be absolutely crazy. And I'm thinking mostly of, like, the wolf brothers that exist in the wolf dream all come storming behind these heroes because the wolf dream is now part of the real world. But that seems too reminiscent of the cursed ghost army from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but as I recall, the heroes of the horn basically rode down out of the clouds and they were riding all over the place in Falma, interacting with the Shan Chan and the White Cloaks, and Brigitte was actually, I believe, seen riding over the waves by somebody, maybe, anyway.
It was men.
I think it was pretty clear that they were actually, you're right, it was men. But I think it's pretty clear that they were actually in our world, because I don't believe all those armies were taken up into Teler Onriad. I think that the battle happened in Falma, and that's the way it was, and that probably doesn't really, really matter that much, but I don't know if it matters so much that Brigitte loses her memories either. I think the upshot of that will be it will end up as though she had been born and matured and became a hero on her own, which she's done life after life, and if she has been ripped away from being bound to the wheel and bound to the horn, then she will, you know, earn that so-called privilege back again. The other thing that always kind of bothered me, you know, a little mispracticality here on a play, you know, Hermione Granger here for a minute, but she's all worried about losing her memories, and in particular losing her memories of Gaedel Kane. Well, could you not write him down, woman? You know, or, I mean, in worst case, find a bard you can trust and recite all these memories to him so he can remember them? Duh.
The pragmatic romantic.
Yeah. You know, they're literate. She could write.
I'm going to do another Mistborn crossover. It's kind of like when we're in the Sazed's head, it talks about how when he pulls out the memory, he has the memory, and when he puts it back, he remembers having the memory. He doesn't necessarily remember all the information. And I think that she's going to have similar kind of experience where she'll remember the fact that she had all the memories and the fact that she was worried about losing them, but she doesn't remember the actual memories. And I think the big question here is not whether she's losing the memories, because I'm not sure if that's what's happening. Although we haven't seen from her point of view, so this is an incredibly crazy theory that I have absolutely nothing to back off. But what if rather than her losing the memories, what if they're just consolidating into one kind of memory? Because she said it herself, a lot of her different lies have been incredibly similar. And so what if they're all just combining to create one mega life has all the experiences she needs to do what she needs to do? Without, you know, all the extraneous stuff that isn't important. Like the swear words and the different dances and exotic dancers and such.
If that happens, how will she confound Elaine with her obscure references to lost cultures, you know? Clearly she's worried about losing the memories because she mentions it over and over again. Elaine mentions that Birgitta is worried about losing all of her memories, and especially the ones of Gaedel Kane, and I think they even reference one time that she remembers now only after a certain date and up until a certain one, which was much less than what she originally remembered when she was first ripped out. But, I don't know. So there's got to be, if she really wants to keep them, there's ways she could do that. There's a point in time where you know you've forgotten some things, but you know you remember others, and she hasn't forgotten enough that she couldn't pull it out and write it down or recite it to somebody or whatever. I mean, God's sake, get like that guy in Warbreaker, Hoyd. You know, get yourself some guy with pockets full of different kinds of stuff to sprinkle on the ground while he recites it back to you. I don't care. Just stop whining about it and do something about it. That's all. I'm kind of frustrated with that sort of attitude. You know, sit there and moan about it and not do anything about it. Doesn't seem like a Birgitta thing to do to me. She's very proactive in dealing with problems, and she's sitting here moaning and, you know, whining about all these memories she's losing. Well, write them down.
No, I think part of that comes with the uniqueness of Birgitta's situation. Yeah, it does get a little frustrating to hear about her continued concern, but I think part of it might stem into the idea that because she wasn't spun out, because she was unnaturally brought into this world, and it was very obvious up until Elaine healed her that she was going to die by being brought into our world the way she was, that the loss of her memories might be a concern because it might be that Elaine's bonding of her didn't actually stop the process, but just slowed it down amazingly. And that, you know, the connection is the more memories I lose, the more identity I lose. If I lose my identity, what does that leave of me? Do I still continue to exist? Or like everything else, like a dream, once you awaken, you know, it's really fresh at first, but, you know, after even a few minutes, you know, it disappears and can be forgotten. And what happens if, to me, the physical person who's existing now, if what I am supposed to be goes away? I know that's horribly philosophical to have brought up, and I am sure we could probably almost fill an entire podcast based on just that one little metaphysical discussion there. But I think that might be where some of her concern is coming from, not just that she's losing memories, which, yes, as you said, she could just really easily have someone write down, but that there might actually be, in her mind, a connection to her physical self and those memories.
Well, one thing that I think she's missing entirely is the fact that when she's spun out naturally, when anyone is spun out naturally, they don't remember their past lives. And so I think that this losing of her memories is an indicator that the pattern is bringing her into conformity with the rest of nature. You're born, you don't remember your past lives. I think the fact that Rand remembers his is because of the taint, if I remember what Semrog says correctly, if we want to believe that Semrog was being truthful. I think a lot of it is the fact that this is absolutely crazy for her. It's even worse than being ripped out of utero. As suddenly you're being attacked, you're being pulled from this place where you're relatively safe, where you know the rules, thrust into a world that you don't know much about, if anything. You're about to die, you're brought up from the brink of death, and then you start worrying because you can't remember all those things that happened before. I think it's just a loss of the familiar that's more what's affecting her than the fact that she's losing her memories. Because she said it herself. She and Gaido Kane always find each other. So the fact that she's losing her memories of him doesn't mean that she won't find him again and fall in love with him again. I have to agree with Virginia. She's whining a bit too much about this. But I don't think that that whining is out of character for her.
But you said normal? You mean you guys don't remember all your past lives? I remember mine.
I come from where I come from, and when I die, I will go back to what I was.
You guys made me think about... You may be too young to remember these movies. I don't know, Back to the Future, when he goes back and changes the past and some of the people in the photograph that he's got with him start fading out of the photograph because the past that he's changed no longer supports them in the future to which he will return. So maybe Birgitte will just fade out as her reality becomes less and less and her memories are gone. Well, I don't like that, though. I don't want that to happen. Listen up, Brandon. Don't want that. Do not want.
Are you
I
Randolph
rainbows
Ford?
At the end.
What? I have a letter for you. Dear Rand, you will probably receive this letter the instant the DeLorean has vanished. Know that I am alive and well, and in 1855... The Doc's alive!
Exactly!
He's in the Old West,
exactly.
But he's alive!
Exactly! Herod Fell is alive! Ah! I totally cast Christopher Lloyd as Herod Fell. Totally.
My extreme apologies to the cast of Something 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 Dark Side for pilfering that line so shamelessly.
Yeah, oh, Virginia? Yeah, we definitely need a DeLorean with a capacitor, the flux capacitor installed. That would really solve a lot of problems in the Wheel of Time.
By the way, Virginia, the Back to the Future series is a classic, and you're never too old to, or you're never too young to know about it.
Oh, thank God. I thought it was just me. You know, I'm suspicious of all my memories because they're sort of fading, too. Although I can't claim being ripped out of Teleron Riad as the cause of that. It seems to be some sort of a natural aging process in this universe, which pretty much sucks. Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I am.
By the way, and Doc has to come back to Rand and say, "You gotta come back! You've gotta come with me right now! It's your kids! They're totally out of control!" All eight of them, or however many there will be.
I am sad to say that I actually do have a few friends who have not seen all of the Back to Future movies, and at least one who doesn't remember the Fraggles, and it pains me greatly.
You sound like the Ogier. They've lost their memories. They've forgotten.
They looked like big, strong hands, don't they?
Okay, we're really going far afield now, and again, I claim total responsibility for this digression. Sorry, people. No, not really.
You mean the Ogier Rock Biter crossover from Neverending Story was just a little too much?
No, it's fine. That's right. I'm telling you, there are two episodes that we need to do. We need to do the ultimate crossover every single thing we can think of episode, And then we also need to do the what's the worst that could happen to everybody episode.
Oh, the Doom Song episode.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Everyone dies at the end. I'm telling you, Brandon, I want rainbows. They better be pooping rainbows at the end of this. I didn't want to go through all this Sturm und Drang for nothing. I want rainbows.
Everyone dies
and puppies.
For Matt and Tuon, who recreate all of civilization
yeah.
by themselves.
Oh, my God.
It's a big
well, that'll
job,
be a
Matt's
race
up
of
to the task.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he is. And I'm sure, well, didn't Fortuana's mother have like 18,000 kids or something and only killed like two or three of them? She sold one as one went as property and another couple killed each other. And I don't know. That's a real stable family.
And then Timurong showed up and killed them all.
If we do the Doom episode, I will definitely find that clip from Invader Zim, just so we can begin the episode with, I'm gonna sing the Doom song!
Okay, so since we've done the Back to the Future crossover, what exactly does Doc say about the kids? He said, Marty, it's your kids something. They are something.
I don't remember now.
It wasn't out of control. It wasn't out of control.
I'd have to rewatch it again. So, I just don't remember at the moment.
Oh, well. If only I had an Ogier memory, but alas. And then somehow into the Doom Song episode, we're going to have to bring Borg Eeyore. I don't know how, but that's your task. Your Herculean task.
And eventually we need to do an episode where we just take one of the sections of Wheel of Time that's just loaded with dialogue and just read it.
I don't know how legal that is. I would have to look up and see how much you can actually read without crossing the line.
It's a fair amount, but... anyway, our next voicemail comes from Greg, and Greg's voicemail deals with Grandal and Asmodian.
Hello, guys. My name is Greg. There's something that's bugging me about Asmodian's death, and I think I have a crazy theory. I'm not sure if it's plausible or not. I personally think that Grandal killed Asmodian. Is it possible, do you think, that in the Gathering Storm, when Rand decides to Balefire the palace that Grendel is in, that when he uses the Balefire, Grendel's dead, Asmodian, his death is nullified, like when Avienda and Matt get killed by Demon Dread. Wait, no, it wasn't Demon Dread, it was Robin, excuse me. And then Rand Balefires him and they come back to life, so. Anyway, is what I'm trying to say is that, do you think since Grendel is dead, that Asmodian at some time in the next couple books will somehow be alive and just walk up and be like, hey guys, here I am. I want to help you guys defeat the Dark One and here we go. So I hope that makes sense. I was just curious if it's something that's been bothering.
I want to really quickly say sorry to Greg because, and you could hear it, he got cut off before he actually got to finish his thought, so... I want to say sorry to him for that. Now we can actually talk about what his crazy theory.
I like that theory. I think it's plausible enough, but I think the time factor is the decider. I think too much time has passed. There probably is no Balefire in the universe powerful enough to bring somebody back over, you know, a span of, surely months has passed since Asmodian was killed and the Gathering Storm. What do you guys think?
I've got two parts on it. For me, and this Greg, you have brought up the age old question of what happens if you Balefire somebody who has just Balefired somebody. We have actually, I think, discussed this now on somewhere on the upwards of 2 to 3 different other podcasts. And never with a successful conclusion we might had. If Asmodian were not Balefired, I believe that Balefire could bring him back if Grandal did kill him. I do also agree with Virginia that the strength of the Balefire would have to be so enormous that I shudder to think of everything else that would have been undone by it. I think so much time would have to have been unraveled that it would probably threaten the stability of the pattern. That being said, if it were possible to Balefire Grandal, and she had killed Asmodian, far back enough to actually be able to bring him back. If she had used Balefire, I still don't think it's possible. And it's because, in my personal opinion, what the effect that Balefire has on the pattern is something that is irreversible. I might be totally wrong about this, but it just seems to me that when it's described, it's describing as burning the thread out of the pattern. And even burning the thread that burned the thread out of the pattern, for me, seems like the original thread burned out of the pattern would still be burned out, regardless of if the thing that caused the burning in the first place were removed. It's incredibly complicated, and I am very certain that I will now be disagreed with, so have at, guys.
Well, no, I actually kind of agree with you. And we know that Robert Jordan was a physicist. Complicated is something that he constantly put into his books. I'm going to bring in even another angle. I don't think that the Balefiring of Grendel would have brought Asmodian back. We do know that Rand used a massive amount of Balefire on the fortress, but that amount of Balefire had a lot of stuff to burn. And so I don't think it would have burned Grendel back far enough to undo the killing of Asmodian, assuming, of course, that she is the one that killed him, which I kind of agree with, but I think there's still enough left unanswered that I'm not going to say, yes, Grendel did. Also, I think a huge indicator that it didn't is the fact that Asmodian wasn't there afterwards. Because I think if we assume that, and this is taking a lot of assumptions, if we assume that Asmodian hadn't been Balefired, then his thread would never have been ended, and it still would have been being weaved along with Rand's thread. And so at the end of that, Asmodian would have been standing there with Rand and Nynaeve and Min. If we think about the example that Greg gave, when Matt and Aviendo were killed by Robin, and then Rand went and Balefired Robin back so far that he hadn't killed them, I don't see, after Robin got Balefired, I don't think that Matt and Aviendo suddenly woke up and they were wondering, oh, what the heck are we doing on the ground? And then they got into a fight. I think it was more, Robin was Balefired, and suddenly Matt and Aviendo are up with all the other warriors doing their part in the battle. And I could be way off base there. But I think that that's the way it would have worked. I don't think that Asmodian, if he did come back, he would come back suddenly locked in a wine closet. He would be back where he naturally would have been if he had been allowed to progress through the pattern.
Now, I'm going to have to disagree on several points there, and I hope I can remember all these because we've gone over at least three topics. I think, first off, the amount of Balefire, even assuming, if we'll take as a given for the moment, which I don't know if it's true or not, but we take as a given for the moment that Grendel was in fact the one that killed Asmodian. The amount of Balefire that Rand used on the palace was great, but it was insignificant compared to some of the uses that were described in the Age of Legends, in which they say that whole cities died in Balefire in those years. And as I recall, and I could be wrong, correct me if I am, the amount of time that went back was only a few days. And the biggest problem with all this was that the people that weren't affected by it remembered certain things happening, which didn't happen to the people that had been recovered by the Balefire. Secondly, I completely disagree with you, Spencer, that Asmodian would have been reappearing in the vicinity of Rand and them at the Palace of Grendel, because we can't assume that he would have, we don't know that he would have stayed with Rand all that time or anything. I believe that when somebody's Balefired, if in fact it had been close enough in time proximity for it to resurrect Asmodian that he would have reappeared in the wine closet in Camelin, because that was the last place that he was. We can't assume that his life would have continued on in the vicinity of Rand or anything else. Anything could have happened. The other thing is with what you were saying, Andrew, and we've disagreed on this before, and we've just agreed to disagree. It's no big. I don't agree with what you said. I do think that if you balefire someone who has just balefired someone else, it's going to burn whatever actions that they just took out of the pattern, which would mean that they did not balefire the person that they balefired, if the time, proximity, and so forth, and the strength of the balefire is adequate to the task. I think that kind of covers it, and I'm trying to remember. I think there was another point, but now I've forgotten it. But anyway, that's I could be totally, totally wrong, and I've been proven to be totally, totally wrong many a time, so I think this is just going to be one of those things that's going to be open for discussion for a long time, unless Brandon sets it down in stone that this is what happens when you balefire a person that is just balefired somebody, or, you know, all these other things are just resolved. And I have a feeling that some of these issues may never really be adequately resolved.
This last one, I think, is a really interesting theory. It comes from Ola, and it's talking about Moraine and Sindane.
Hello, this is Ola from Norway. I have a crazy theory, and it's about why Sindane is much weaker in the One Power now than she was before the Finns touched her. And I believe that after falling through the doorway to Rungriel, Moraine might have requested that they sort of switch the strength of Lanfear with that of Moraine, so that Moraine became far stronger while Lanfear became much weaker. In return, of course, Moraine agreed to stay her as a prisoner after giving her two odd requests. I love this podcast, and I ask you to keep up the good work. It's very fun to listen to. Bye-bye.
First off, thank you, Ola. This voicemail, actually, he recorded and sent to us via email, and you would notice that the sound quality was much greater. And that's because he took the time to do that. It isn't necessary, you know, we can get... But it is nice that he was willing to do that.
I was just going to say is that the... yes, for those of you who are not able to access our usual 800 number, if you'd like to send us a voice recording, you can just record yourself an MP3 and email it to the podcast page. It's another definite way... in which we can hear from you. I know the voicemail is not viable to those listeners who are from other countries. It's really nice to hear. I'm amazingly impressed that we have gotten both voicemails from India and from Norway now in the same podcast. It's really, really, really cool.
Anyway, not to talk about the actual theory. Like I said before, I think this is a really interesting theory. It's not one that I've heard of before. Honestly, I'm not sure what side of the fence I sit on this one. Because I've heard other plausible theories as to why Sindane is so much weaker than Lanfear.
Because she deserved it?
I'm not exactly sure either. I mean, it is possible. I mean, we don't really know the full extent of what the Finns are capable of. It is possible that they might be capable of draining capacity from one channeler and bestowing it upon another. I think I've always kind of originally assumed that the reason Lanfear as Sindane is so much weaker than Lanfear was as Lanfear was that the Dark One basically had to find a channeler's body to put her into, and they kind of just had to take what was available, that being Sindane, who was a good deal weaker in the power than Lanfear, and that capacity might be somewhat genetic, and therefore the new body's ability just wasn't up to par with what Lanfear was used to. I do kind of like the idea that maybe when we get Moraine back, she will be uber shibby keen and, like, totally hopped up on even more awesomeness than she was when she left. But I don't know.
I'm going to have to disagree with you, Andrew, about the body theory, because we can assume, because of Halima Erengar, that the ability to channel has more to do with the soul than the body. The body probably does have to have a conduit, but I think it's more important that the soul, because Erengar is a man trapped in a woman's body, and so it channels Sadeen, even though it should channel Sadar. I don't think that the body that she was put into would be the force of the restriction or the lessening of the power or the lessening of her channeling ability.
I can accept that. What you say does make a good amount of sense. I'm vaguely remembering a conversation with a reinvested Forsaken that seemed to mention something about, well, this was all that was available, and I think I probably have gotten them crossed over, probably actually crossing over Erengar and the complaint originally that he was in a woman's body with Lanfear's complaint that she is not as powerful as she used to be. So it is very possible that you're right, there might have been an extra kind of stipulation or effect from having been captured by the Finns and subsequently having to probably die in order to escape from them.
I guess one thing that sort of bothers me about this whole situation is that in order for these, reinvestments, as you call them, or transmogrifications or whatever they might be, we're in either case, we're sort of relying on I'm probably going to butcher this, Dux Ex Machina, the force of God. In this case, either the Dark One or the Finns having some mysterious power to do whatever they want, and not play by the natural rules of the physical world. And that just kind of bothers me. I've always sort of assumed that Sindane's weakness was due to a punishment by the Dark One, but I could just as equally espouse the theory that that was some machinations of the Finns that were involved in her having entered the way she did and the Dark One bailing her out. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how, I mean, the Ilfin and the Elfin are supposedly not really of this world. I mean, I don't know how much influence the Dark One has. I mean, are they kind of outside of time, which even the Dark One can't step? Or, I mean, how else are they able to stand outside the pattern and read it? Although I do remember one point where I believe it was Morden who said he actually stepped outside the pattern himself. So that must be possible. Oh, not. This is like time travel. It really is giving me a headache. Kind of like Captain Janeway. But it bugs me that the Finns are so powerful that they presumably can do all of these amazing things that have no relation to our physical universe and physical reality. I know what my train of thought was. I wonder, did the Dark One have to make a bargain with the Finns to get Sindane basically sprung? Or was he able to just say, I'm taking her, here she goes, bye? I don't know. This is getting very metaphysical, but I can't decide which would be more likely. They're all unlikely.
Well, the thing about the Finns is we don't know that much about them. When we introduce the Finns into different theories, we also introduce the theory that the Finn have a certain power that they may or may not have, but there can be an argument made that they do. I mean, the most that we know of the Finn is one side grants wishes, the other side answers questions. We assume that the side that grants wishes has a large store of Terangriel and other items, and that's about all we know, besides the fact that, you can access them to the Tower of Genji. Back on the Sindane issue, the first thought is, oh, well, she was somehow stilled and was healed by a woman. and so she doesn't have as much power as she once did. You know, like what happened with Suan Sanche and Liang. You know, I think that's too easy. I think that would be too easy a cop-out for Robert Jordan. Of course, similarly, you know, you apply Occam's Razor and the simplest explanation... It is Occam's Razor, isn't it? Occam's Razor, you know, the simplest explanation is most likely the most correct. And
yeah,
so
Occam's Razor,
say,
I believe. That's how it's called.
Occam's Razor, yeah. And so applying that principle, you know, Sindane might have just been stilled or severed and not healed properly. We can assume that the Dark One knows that in order to heal a female back to her full potential, you have to use a male, and vice versa. So it could very easily be a punishment that was administered in that way. But, you know, I think there's enough unknowns here that any theory at all is still plausible. Like you said, you know, there is a lot of this where we're assuming that the Finns can do things that we don't have any evidence either way, whether they can or not.
I don't know. You know, as far as the Finns go, I sort of have always come down on the idea that she was probably killed and or stilled when she went through the doorway that melted with Moraine. Possibly that was part of her bargain with the Ilfin or the Ilfin, that, you know, she should be restored to channeling if she was stilled, and, you know, maybe part of the price was maybe that she left some of her power with them. I don't know. I've always sort of liked Andrew's theory that the Finns might have actually been responsible for teaching humanity how to channel and how to make Angreal and Sangreal and Turangreal, and that's how they're able to get their hands on all these things, like the fox head and so forth and so on, to give to Matt, whatever. But and again, my other crazy theory is that I'm really hoping, you know, I had all these hopes for Semirog being able to heal Rhaen. I'm going to still try to ride the Moraine coming out of the land of the Finns with some new and powerful knowledge or Turangreal or some item that will help the Dragon Reborn, and she'll come riding to the rescue at the last battle, you know, trailing clouds of glory. But, you know, I'll probably get shot down on that just like everything else. I don't think, like I say, I don't think there's going to be a lot of rainbows at the end of this series. Hope that I'm wrong.
Well, you know, another prevalent Sindane theory is that the Finn were somehow responsible for both Lanfear's exceedingly great strength and her exceeding beauty. And that when she went back, especially in such an explosive manner, that they took those gifts away or something. And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of other theories out there that we don't know about and we haven't covered. And, you know, we won't know until after the book has been published that says this and this and this are so.
On that particular note, like Spencer said, there are lots of theories that are out there that we have probably never heard. And if you have one, there are several ways that you can send them in to us so that you too might like all of the wonderful people who have contributed to this particular podcast and the ones preceding it share your ideas with the rest of the Wheel of Time community. Of course, once again, thank you to everyone who has sent in voicemails for these last few episodes. If you yourself would like to call and leave us a voicemail, you can do so at 1-888-333-7690.
And if you want to do like Ola did, or just send us a text email, our email address is podcast@dragonmount.com. Depending on how close we are to our computers and personal digital assistants and such, if you send an email to there, you might actually get a response within minutes, but you will get responded to within the week, usually within the day.
And usually by one or more of us.
Yeah, you can start entire threads of conversation with one email. It's great.
You can record your own MP3 and just attach it to the email, or if it should be too big, you could, you know, upload it and just email a link to it, and then we can get your voicemail that way if you don't have access to the voicemail, as Andrew said earlier. You can also find us and follow us on a number of the social networking sites. We have a Fourth Age page on Facebook, and so does Dragon Mount, our host. And also you can follow us on Twitter. We are Fourth Age with no space, and also Dragon Mount has a Twitter account. And I think that's pretty much it. I really don't think that the MySpace page is being updated anymore. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think anybody's really doing that. We're pretty much focusing on Facebook and Twitter right now. You can also leave us comments on the actual podcast pages where the podcast is posted on dragonmount.com. People a lot of times will have a whole stream of comments back and forth, you know, after each episode, so you can do that. And then
Virginia talked about Dragon Mount, our host website. We are so thankful for them for hosting our podcast, especially as sporadic as it has been in recent history. And they are attempting to use a new community. I'm not even sure. Community page, community source. I'm not sure what. They have a new community feature that they're using in addition to the forums. So the original podcast forums are still there. You can still get to them by going to forums.dragonmount.com. But also in the new community beta page that Dragonmount has going, there is a Fourth Age page. I'm not even sure what it is in this new format. But there's a place for the Fourth Age podcast there. And as yet, we haven't had much to do with it. We're going to try and get some more, start using it more often. So hopefully in the future, when we get to know more about how this is working and how we can use it, we'll definitely be start using Dragon Mount's new feature that they've installed.
And we do want to thank everybody for putting up with us in our sporadic publication. We really do record often. It's just that there are times when none of us can get together on the same days for a week or two, but for the most part, we record every week. Again, and I'm sorry that this is the continuing excuse, but it's the editing that is the big hang-up. And for some reason, it's rarer that we can get anybody to edit more than one or two or three podcasts, because I just really think that once people realize the amount of time involved in doing an edit job, they just don't have that time in their lives, because it's about 3 or 4 to 1 as far as time. By the time you listen and cut and paste and edit and maybe have to adjust the volumes a little bit or whatever. But yeah, if you're going to have a 1 hour episode, you're looking at 3 to 4 hours of editing time. And it's just too much for most people in their lives. And we're working on trying to figure out how to get around that. And we've tried to have teams of people, and at one point in time, we had 3 or 4 people, and we were able to get out episodes pretty rapidly, but it's very difficult. It's an unpaid position. It's a labor of love, and we always need new editors. So if you have audio editing skills and you want to contribute to the Fourth Age and Dragon Mount, please just send us an email. You're almost guaranteed to get at least an immediate response. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you'll be able to edit just about as many as you want to. And, you know, we provide a lot of freedom in that. You know, the editing is, it's pretty free form. We try to keep our episodes casual and everything. So that unfortunately means that there's a lot of just stuff that just needs to hit the cutting room floor. We don't work with a script. And so consequently, the editing can be time consuming. So if you want to give it a go, you're almost certain to get the job. You know, and then if you don't like it, no harm, no foul. But we would love to have some more help. Help!
And on that note, we want to thank everyone who called in and gave us their theories, their ideas, their feedback, and corrected us where we were wrong. And thankful for everyone who gave us their voicemail. We're trying really hard. We'll get more stuff out to you.
That should basically wrap up this episode of voicemails. We want to thank everybody again for contributing with their voicemails and emails. We really appreciate it. And so in the meantime, this is Virginia saying, may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyanin Tomanshima, Taishite. I just love the gall of sending the guy in so that he would get all compulsionified and then bail firing and go check him again.
Yeah. That was pretty rude. I'm sorry. I'm trying to coordinate with our New Zealand friends for Disneyland tomorrow. And I really feel so up to Disneyland.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. It's just been failed. No, I'm sorry, I totally...
It's the happiest place to fall over dead.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure I probably will. And I think it'll be a great relief. So, I'm sorry, do you remember where your train of thought was before I so rudely interrupted you with my ringing phone?
Yes.
Good. And then please proceed.